You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
Me neither.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, yeah. There's that.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe. And of course, Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com, thank you for joining us for another thrilling action-packed adventure, as this is perhaps, I don't know, perhaps the calm before the storm. I'm not going to go into too many details about Iowa until our next thrilling broadcast. I will have some thoughts, however, on Iowa and some new polling in Iowa as it affects not just Iowa but the rest of the race in a moment. And we'll be talking about the broader picture of the media and their coverage of the presidential contest to date, specifically on the Democratic side. Get to that in a moment. Also, we've got an update here today, finally, from the DNC, a story we've been following over the last few days. The DNC has now reached an agreement in principle, according to AP, to have the party sanction and manage more debates during the presidential primary schedule, including a debate in New Hampshire this week following the Iowa caucuses and prior to people going to the first-in-the-nation primary in New Hampshire next Tuesday. The DNC says it wants to give Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley time to focus on Monday's Iowa caucuses. That statement from the DNC comes after both Clinton and Sanders campaigns had traded testy statements, says AP, about plans for Thursday's debate in New Hampshire. This would be that new debate in New Hampshire this Thursday that just sort of came out of thin air last week, as announced by the New Hampshire union leader and MSNBC. It's something that Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders have been calling for a long time. But then once it was announced, once it looked like, well, you know what, Hillary's flagging in the polls, Bernie doing well in New Hampshire, all of a sudden Bernie Sanders wasn't quite as eager to hold more debates. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is he, frankly, was in the middle of negotiations, and he used his new status atop many of the polls in New Hampshire and a number of them in Iowa to get not just a new debate this week, but three or four future new debates as well to not be held on a weekend or a holiday, as so many had been previous to this, as set by the DNC, Democratic National Committee, who has been charged with trying to help Hillary's campaign by hiding these debates on the weekends for Democrats and, frankly, holding very few of them. So we will see. We will get details on this new debate that will probably be later this week, probably on Thursday night of this week. We will see. We'll get more of those details as we move forward. And I'm sure, Desi Doyen, you are delighted about it, right? Because the more debates...
More work for me.
There you go.
You know, actually, I am, as a citizen, I am glad that this is finally coming out. Mm-hmm. I am glad to see that there are finally going to be, maybe, if we're lucky, in principle, more debates and an opportunity for voters to actually hear about the specific policies that the different Democratic candidates have proposed. Because right now, we don't really get to hear a whole lot about that.
Which allows that's, of course, Desi, our producer, that allows the media to get away with a lot of the stuff that they're getting away with when they are covering this election, when they are reporting on Bernie Sanders, when they are regarding him as some sort of a fringe lunatic candidate, an outsider. Well, we're going to talk about that in a moment. So, yeah, I mean, I, too, share your dread of having to cover them as they're going to start coming fast and furious now with the Democratic debate on Thursday, Republican on Saturday. I'm sure our friend Heather Digby Parton will be delighted to hear she will be back time and time again. At least I hope. Yeah, so I share that dread, but I also, you know, the more democracy, the better. Sounds good to me. And holding these debates not on the weekends, not over a holiday, will be a good idea. Anyway, we'll get back to presidential politics in a moment. But I wanted to get to this story. I want to make sure we get this story because this sort of snuck out over the weekend with few people noticing, and I haven't heard it discussed very much. This comes from Reuters. The U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has decided not to impose any further punishment on David Petraeus, the former U.S. military commander and CIA director who admitted sharing classified information with his lover. That, according to a letter seen by Reuters, Petraeus resigned as head of the CIA in 2012 after it was revealed that he was having an affair with his biographer, Paula Broadwell, when he pled guilty to mishandling classified information. A court document signed by Petraeus and prosecutors said that in 2011, Petraeus illegally gave Broadwell access to official binders. He was a four-star general. He retired and was sentenced to just 2 years of probation. And he was fined $100,000, but spared any time in prison after pleading guilty to, well, you know, mishandling classified information. He was the head of the CIA. He just mishandled the classified information. The Pentagon, of course, could have sought further reprimand for Petraeus under military law. The letter from, who was this from? Stephen Hedger, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Legislative Affairs. That letter was addressed to the Senate saying there would be no further punishment, or at least they're calling for no further punishment for Petraeus. That letter was sent to the Senate Armed Services Committee, to the chair of that committee, John McCain, and to fellow senators Jack Reed, who had recently asked Defense Secretary Carter to not take any more action against Petraeus. Let him off easy. He shared confidential information with his lover, who could have easily blackmailed him. But let's let him off easy. Just like we let Edward Snowden off easily. Oh, wait. Exactly what did Petraeus share, by the way? Far worse, arguably, than the information that whistleblower Edward Snowden, who is still stuck in Russia, unable to leave for fear of facing arrest by the U.S. and being unable to argue his case in response in court as a whistleblower, because they won't let him argue his case in response under the things he's currently charged with. In any event, Petraeus shared something known as black books. These are the binders that Petraeus had shared with Broadwell containing classified information, including identities of covert officials, something that Edward Snowden never shared. Neither did Bradley Manning. Identities of covert officers, code word information, again, something that was not shared by these other people, war strategy, intelligence capabilities, diplomatic talks and information from high-level White House National Security Council meetings, including those with Barack Obama. This was shared, remember, keep in mind here, he didn't share it because he thought there was some sort of law-breaking going on, some sort of rule-breaking, something the American public needed to know about. Unlike Edward Snowden, who was, you know, who felt very strongly, you may or may not agree, but felt very, very strongly that what the NSA was doing was unconstitutional. And of course, courts and even the president of the United States has come out since to agree with them. The law has been changed based in no small part because of the revelations of Edward Snowden. What David Petraeus was doing was no such thing. He was sharing these incredibly high level, incredibly classified, incredibly confidential documents with his girlfriend so he would look good. She was working on a book about him. So he was doing this to make himself look good to his girlfriend, to his biographer. This was not to, to change the law. This was not to blow the whistle. So he shared much higher level of classified documents. He did not do so for any whistleblowing reason or anything else, and yet he is let off with the slap on the wrist. 2 years probation, $100,000 fine, which I'm sure he had no trouble paying. He now serves as the chairman of the private equity firm Kohlberg, Kravis and Roberts Economic and Geopolitical Think Tank, the KKR Global Institute. So he works. He continues to have a job. He's just fine. He's got people at the highest level telling him to go give this guy a break. No more, no further punishment for him. Everything is fine. And the military goes along with it. Meantime, Edward Snowden is a terrorist. We've got to destroy him. We've got to apprehend him. We've got to arrest him. We've got to throw him in jail. Just unbelievable hypocrisy in this country. Just unbelievable hypocrisy. So David Petraeus, he's off and running. Good luck to you, Mr. Petraeus. All is well. It was all worth it, wasn't it? Man, unbelievable. All right, we will take a quick break and come back to talk about that with someone who has been following the corporate mainstream media's unfair and inappropriately balanced. Yes, balance is not a good thing in this case. The inappropriately balanced misreporting by the mainstream media for a long time. We're going to take a quick break, and we will come back and talk with Jim Noricus of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He joins us next. This is The Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
You are listening to yesterday's Bradcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. Fox News long ago invented the ridiculous slogan, fair and balanced, suggesting that they, unlike the rest of the corporate media, was both. It is a ridiculous slogan, of course, as you know, on a number of levels. First and foremost, of course, because the right-wing Fox News, long the propaganda arm for the Republican Party itself, is run by the man who ran Richard Nixon's campaigns. And it is, of course, neither fair nor balanced, as you know. For them, for Fox News, the slogan is as much of a scam, frankly, as much of a Jedi mind trick for their viewers as the Great Con that I, at least as I've described, the Great Con underscoring much of the GOP's central efforts over the past 35 years, specifically Ronald Reagan's line that government isn't the solution, government is the problem. That notion that government is bad and private enterprise is good has led to the privatization of key government functions over the years, virtually none of which have made government either better or more accountable to we the people, but it has made a lot of it's made a lot of the wealthy corporations and their owners even wealthier, and has otherwise increased the price for certain basic government functions in the bargain, as the profit motive for those private corporations has now been built in to those functions. Reagan's great con, frankly, about government has also served to frighten many Americans, to con them, in fact, into believing that government is somehow the enemy of the people and that only the private sector really knows how to run things correctly. Like a business. Never mind that government and business are two entirely separate entities, or at least they used to be, and that they should be run in entirely different ways. But once again, business is about financial profits for its shareholders. That's the fiduciary duty of a for-profit corporation. Meanwhile, government is about helping its people to live, to be healthy, to improve their lives, to keep them safe, to help them get a fair shot, to help them against many of those corporate interests that so many in America, particularly on the Republican side, now believe to be superior to overseeable and accountable government. Over the years, much of the rest of the media, the non-Fox media, have been bullied into responding to the inherent criticism built into Fox's wildly successful slogan claiming fairness and balance. The rest of the media have taken it to mean that the rest of that media needs to be more fair and more balanced. Well, heck, of course they do, because look how successful Fox News is. Now, we have long argued here at bradblog.com and here on the Bradcast that fairness is one thing, but balance is BS. And if the things you are reporting are not inherently balanced, they should not be reported as such. We do our readers and we do our listeners and our viewers a disservice by creating this false balance where there is none. So if 99% of climate scientists and their scientific reports find that the Earth is now warming at an alarming rate due to man-made global warming, then reporting the facts just like that is the right thing to do. But you've got so many in the media who will report, Republicans, however, maintain there is no evidence of global warming, or climate change is always changing, and climate is always changing, and therefore there's nothing we can do about it. That does a spectacular disservice to the public. Nonetheless, mainstream corporate media still seems to ill-serve all of us by looking for that phony balance, by reporting in what they believe to be a balanced way, even when no such balance exists. And we've seen a lot of this lately in the way that mainstream media, both broadcast media and, as we'll talk about in a moment, mainstream print publications, the way that they've been dealing with the primary campaigns, and specifically in the way Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side is frequently equated with Donald Trump on the Republican side. They're both outsiders. They're taking on the party's establishment on behalf of angry voters or whatever the lazy media outlets tell us, and thus acquainting the long-serving public official Bernie Sanders with the reality show showman, fact-free, Fox News-created presidential campaign of businessman turned TV star Donald Trump. But they're both the same in much of the media. One's an outsider taking over the Republican Party, moving it farther to the right. The other is an outsider taking over the Democratic Party, moving it to the far left. Over the weekend, the New York Times, which has now endorsed Hillary Clinton for the primary, described Iowa voters' apparent, quote, embrace of candidates on the ideological fringes of their parties, placing both Trump and Sanders into that extreme fringe of each of their parties. Quote, both Democrats and Republicans, the Times' Trip Gabriel instructed readers over the weekend, have seen their presumptive nominees of a year ago, deeply experienced, proven political leaders, brushed aside by Iowans in favor of idle, smashing outsiders. But does that description, does all of that really just turn into false balance? Is there any actual relationship with that that description to facts at all? Or is this merely the false balance that we see so much in the corporate media now as a substitute for actual truth telling, no matter whose ox gets gored in the process of educating the electorate with facts and the truth?
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
Here to talk about all of this and this frankly disturbing, continually disturbing phenomenon is Jim Norikis. He's the editor of FAIR.org, the website of fairness and accuracy in reporting. Since 1990, Jim has edited Extra, which is FAIR's print publication, now a monthly newsletter. He's also co-author of The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. Jim's worked as an investigative reporter for the newspaper In These Times, covering the Iran-Contra scandal. He was managing editor of the Washington Report on the Hemisphere, a newsletter on Latin America. Jim Norikis, sir, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thanks for having me on again.
Great to have you here. All right, Jim, the way New York Times, and they're not the only ones, we'll talk about Chicago Tribune and some of these others, but the way the New York Times characterized Bernie Sanders over the weekend as an outsider, you wrote about this point for FAIR over the weekend. Where does Gabriel and the New York Times get this point simply wrong, just right from the jump, as you see it, in this long piece that ran over the weekend in the New York Times?
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times and much of the corporate media are really trying to maintain the idea that there are acceptable candidates within the circle of acceptable ideas and candidates who are beyond the pale, who decent voters should turn their back on, and they should listen to the New York Times and vote for one of the approved candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they make this judgment clearly in terms of who is part of a web of, they approve you approve them, mm-hmm. and and that makes you part of the club.
Well, they went so far as to call them.
I can't say that. That's not something that would make sense to the readers of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, many people are suspicious of people who are deeply embedded in the web of interrelationships that makes up the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't say, you know, vote for these people because they're part of the establishment. So you try to make up a different reason. And the reasons that are offered are, you know, as in this Trip Gabriel article, some of the candidates are acceptable because they're deeply experienced and proven.
Right.
And then you've got the inexperienced, unproven candidates. And they're basically talking about Sanders on the Democratic side and Trump and Cruz
mm-hmm.
on the Republican side. And it does, you know, you can make these, Trump doesn't have any government experience.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been proven in politics before. It's not true of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has a long record in government. And it's not true of Ted Cruz either. You know, they're trying to contrast Ted Cruz with Jeb Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Cruz has actually had, you know, quite a bit more experience in government than Jeb Bush has.
He's been
experience in the administration of Jeb Bush's brother.
Mm-hmm.
But they're offering this idea to try to get people to come to their senses and vote for a New York Times approved candidate.
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
And Cruz has, just to underscore what your point here, Ted Cruz has been in government for about 13 years. The presumptive nominee, the approved candidate on the Democratic side would be Hillary Clinton. She's had 12 years of experience in government. Jeb Bush, you point out in your article, what did he have?
10 years, counting
years.
A stint as the Commerce Secretary for Florida.
But compared to Bernie Sanders, he's had 33 years in elective office as mayor in Vermont, as two-year terms as mayor. He was in the House of Representatives for 16 years, senator for two terms, and yet somehow he is not. He's an outsider with 33 years in office with more than just about all of those candidates I just mentioned combined?
Yeah, it's clear that your experience doesn't count if the policies that you are promoting are not approved by the New York Times. And if you aren't, you know, part of the team is the real issue for the New York Times.
I think you're right, because it can't be about time in office, and it can't even be about popularity, because obviously, you know, Bernie Sanders is drawing crowds larger than Donald Trump even. But
another issue that is presented as a reason not to vote for candidates who are not establishment approved is that they are unelectable. Because some candidates appeal to the broad, sensible center, as
right.
the Chicago Tribune put it.
Yes.
And other candidates don't. You know, and again, it's candidates like Bush and Clinton are supposedly the ones who appeal to the center, and candidates like Sanders and like Cruz and Trump do not appeal to the center. And you can't really prove this by looking at polls. The candidate who appeals to the broad, sensible center, Hillary Clinton, does less well in matchups with the Republicans
than Bernie Sanders does.
Do.
Yeah, she does. Well, Bernie Sanders does better against the Republican.
Sanders.
Yeah, than Hillary Clinton does. But also, according to those polls, but also according to polls as well, the things that Bernie Sanders calls for are in fact seemingly, in fact, what was the phrase there? The center, the ideological center. They are popular ideas. Single payer. This is a popular idea. Paying for, you know, allowing free tuition to public colleges. Breaking up the banks. These are actually things that are wildly popular, not just with the Democrats, but also with the Republicans. And yet the New York Times describes this, you know, supporters of Bernie Sanders as voters on the ideological edges.
Yeah,
the fringe.
Center is a very tricky idea. The way that corporate media use the word center is not the way that ordinary people use it. You'd think that it means the policies that are embraced by a majority of the people are centrist policies.
Right.
That's not what they mean in the media. They mean policies that are embraced by the establishment. And they can be even policies that are quite unpopular, like cutting Social Security to reduce the deficit is a centrist idea that is wildly unpopular. But it's something that people who think of themselves as smart, sophisticated media pundits will say, well, that's a centrist idea that people should get behind. And it's really kind of a shell game on the part of the media to try to present these ideas that have very little popular support as the ideas of the middle.
And this was Chicago Tribune, which has long, of course, been moving to the right, is now, I would argue, even far right. They talked about the broad, sensible center. They talked about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump as if they were the same, one for the Republicans, one for the Democrats. These are candidates who would be, quote, politically disastrous by turning off the broad, sensible center. And your argument, Jim Noricus, is they're just making that up? I mean, they're just coming out with the idea that the Chicago Tribune itself is just simply determining what the sensible center is, never mind what the polls actually show?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some things you can say that Trump and Cruz, Sanders have in common. I think that in both cases they are outside of their... They're not close to their party establishment. Sanders is not a registered Democrat. And Trump is someone who has a kind of hostile relationship with the leadership of the Republican Party. And I think that their supporters on both sides appreciate that and find that an attractive quality. There are other ways in which they're really not very similar. And one of those ways is that Trump is not very popular outside of his own support base, whereas Sanders is, of all the candidates running for office, with the possible exception of Ben Carson, has the most favorable rating in polls. He's got the most people who like him compared to the people who dislike him. You know, he's pretty broadly popular because I think he has, you know, when he picks issues like universal health care and free tuition, he's picking these because he knows that they're popular.
Right.
He knows that the things that people like, and that's why he's offering them. Trump, with his, you know, his signature policies involve, you know, banning Muslims and putting a wall up on the U.S. southern border. He's picked these not because they are popular, but because they resonate with a core group of supporters. You know, they're not broadly popular, but they do strike a chord with the people he's trying to attract. He's really aiming more for fervent support among a smaller group of people, whereas the goal of the Sanders campaign, I think, is to get broad support by offering policies that are beneficial to a wide group of people.
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that also makes the false equivalency between Trump and Sanders, which underscores it, is, you know, since you mentioned, Jim, you know, his call to ban all Muslims. Well, that would be illegal. That would be unconstitutional. Frankly, it would be in complete opposition to his own party's establishment position. But and I was hard pressed. That was because I was thinking about this earlier, to come up with something that Sanders has ever called for, you know, throughout this campaign, or really any time, you know, anything that he has ever called for, to my knowledge, that is, well, either illegal or unconstitutional or even out of line with the general direction of the Democratic Party. I mean, even if you might prefer Hillary Clinton, you might disagree with Sanders on this point or that, nothing that he is calling for is, you know, just in strict opposition to what Democrats have called for as a party for years, whereas, you know, you've got Trump and arguably Ted Cruz completely off their reservations. They are forcing the party to them rather than building on what it is that the party already, you know, sort of stands for. Single-payer health care has been popular amongst Democrats for years and years. So it seems to do a disservice to Sanders.
I think part of the reaction that you get in the media against someone like Sanders has to do with the fact that Democrats for decades have been striving to appear realistic. They really are sort of haunted by the spirit of 1972 you know, where the
George McGovern.
The idea is that the Democrats picked a super liberal candidate and lost badly, mm-hmm. and they never want that to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been kind of the mantra of the Democrats in every subsequent election, starting with Jimmy Carter. And both Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have expressed a feeling that the ideal way to set up a healthcare system would be to have government paying the bills mm-hmm. under a single-payer system. Their objection to this is not that it would be a bad idea, but that it would be politically impossible.
Right.
That you can't get something like that past the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies that have a very powerful voice in Washington. And so the Democratic establishment has really tried to avoid taking on issues like that, that they think would provoke mm-hmm. strong opposition from the corporate lobbies that protect the interests of big business in this country. And Bernie Sanders is, by saying, no, we're gonna do this anyway, even though big business will not like it,
mm-hmm.
that he is challenging the Democratic Party orthodoxy and also challenging corporate media orthodoxy. That
right.
has been very sympathetic to this kind of realism on the part of the Democratic Party.
And I use
realism not in the sense of actual respect for reality, but realism is defined kind of like the way a senator is defined. It's realistic to go along with the powerful, and it's unrealistic to challenge the powerful.
It's the conventional wisdom. I mean, it's the media conventional wisdom. We believe these things can happen. We believe that policy can only be within this window, and anything outside of that is just crazy, insane fringe.
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
Jim Noricus, I got just another minute or two here, but there's been, the amount of coverage given to the candidates, particularly in the mainstream media, has been wildly, speaking of balance, wildly unbalanced, with the amount going to Donald Trump versus really everybody else, but specifically versus both Sanders and Clinton. I mean, in both cases, Sanders and Clinton, they certainly represent as many or more voters than Donald Trump does. And in Bernie Sanders' case, he's drawing huge crowds, arguably larger often than Donald Trump. So I think we know about that imbalance, and with that, which seems to me to be very troubling in and of itself. But with that in mind, does print coverage, the type that you've been so critical of at both the New York Times and at the Chicago Tribune and elsewhere, does print coverage even matter? Are these nuances that don't really even matter to voters anymore? Is it all about TV and frankly, what makes it into viral social media at this point? Or does it matter what the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and the L.A. Times and so forth have to say, and these nuances you're writing about?
You know, I do think it matters. And I think that in a way to talk about, television is still a big medium, but the biggest medium now really is the Internet. And the old line, old school mm-hmm. media outlets like the New York Times have a tremendous footprint on the web. They're being shared through social media. You know, social media doesn't create a lot of media. It spreads around media that's already there, and it's often the old line media that people are spreading socially.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it matters. I do think that they still have a tremendous ability to set the terms of debate, and I think we're seeing right now a real pushback against that, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well,
whether social media can counteract the attempt by traditional media to put boundaries on what can be debated and what can't.
And that's sort of where I want to leave you with this question. I realize neither you nor I are in the business of predictions here, but do you expect that the mainstream media coverage will change in the event that Sanders does win in Ohio and New Hampshire, that he has, actually demonstrated by the voters to be more within the mainstream? Will this push media to corporate media to, cover him more fairly? Or will this sort of skewed reporting as Bernie as a fringe candidate, as the New York Times characterized him over the weekend, will that simply get worse? Will the media sort of push back even more against candidates like Bernie Sanders if he is successful?
Well, in some ways, Sanders is comparable to Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labor Party in Britain.
Right.
And he originally got the same kind of dismissive, that's never going to happen coverage that Sanders is getting, that Sanders has been getting.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got control, when voters chose him mm-hmm. as the leader of the Labour Party, the coverage got a lot nastier. Mm-hmm. And particularly from outlets, like The Guardian, that are traditionally sympathetic to the Labour Party,
mm-hmm.
they were the nastiest. And I think that if Sanders does show a real challenge to the party establishment mm-hmm. in the Democratic Party, I think that you'll see some very nasty coverage indeed.
And that's just works out fantastic for Republicans, because they can see media outlets like New York Times, going after even harder after Bernie Sanders, and Fox News can still call them the quote unquote liberal New York Times. Man, it seems like the right wingers always win in these cases. Which is why, you know what, now it's up to the people, hopefully, and the people turn out and vote for whomever they want to vote for. Because it drives me crazy when you see the folks on the right just, whining and complaining about their unfair treatment in the media, and then you look at what is actually going on, and it is so much just the opposite of that, and the opposite of the complaints that folks on the right love to make, and it's become their industry. And following that industry and calling them out for it one way or another on the right and left is Jim Noricus of fair.org, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Jim, always great to talk to you and helpful to enjoy your perspective since you've been doing this for so many years. Thank you, sir. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Check out Jim's work on the web at fair.org. And, of course, on the Twitters, he is J. Noricus. That's JNAURECKAS on the Twitters. Okay, a quick break, and we are back with more broadcast right after this. And one more lie that has been driving me crazy about right-wingers. Well, we'll get to that. It has to do with Donald Trump. You'll be shocked to learn right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your broadcast. Don't touch that dial.
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
Well, as long as we're talking about lies, Republican lies, lies about the Republican Party, lies about the Democratic Party by the media. One of the lies that has driven me crazy for years, as Brad blog readers and broadcast listeners will know, along with the Fox News fair and balanced lie, along with the Ronald Reagan, one small government. The problem is not the government. How does it go? The
government is the problem.
There we go. Right. Government is not the solution. Government is the problem. Another one of these persistent zombie lies forever that drives me crazy, and even among Democrats, is describing Republicans as conservative. As the conservative party. They're not conservative. Most of them, Fox News doesn't give a damn about conservatism. Conservatism, they've rebranded conservatism to basically equal Republicans, whatever Republicanism, whatever it is that Republicans want. Oh, that's conservative. Well, that is not conservative. There is a very specific definition for conservatism. And it is not, the big government of Ronald Reagan and of George W. Bush, who, both increased government spending. It is not the big government intrusiveness into the lives of Americans to keep them from marrying who they love, to get between a woman and her doctor when it comes to abortion. That is not conservatism. And yet they've rebranded basically anything that Republicans do as conservatism because, conservative sells better. It has been at least for a long time a better, better branding than liberalism, which Republicans, destroyed years ago, going all the way back to George Bush Sr. Liberal with an L, card carrying liberal. Anyway, I think that the one thing that maybe we can thank Donald Trump for is underscoring the fact that Republicans are not conservative. As some of even Trump's opponents in Iowa and New Hampshire are, you know, making quite clear now. This was, whose mailer was this? This was, I think this was a Cruz mailer or Rubio, I'm not sure. In any event, Donald Trump is a lot of things. A consistent conservative is not one of them. Well, that is true. And yet, the supporters of Trump, they don't care. You know, he's called for all kinds of things that are decidedly not conservative, and Republican voters simply don't seem to care. Philip Klein, pointing out over at Washington Post, he carefully categorizes the various Republican voter groups, and he concludes that the persistence of Trumpism, according to Greg Sargent, suggests that the party is far more divided than we thought. Well, not more than I thought, but anyway, here's the description. Here's what he says is driving Trump voters. Trump supporters aren't particularly ideological. They are frustrated because they think that America is in decline economically, culturally, and militarily, threatened by other nations on the world stage and by foreigners here at home. They don't care about economic arguments in favor of free trade or constitutional arguments for executive restraint. They don't bat an eye when Trump touts the importance of government seizures of private property for non-public use, eminent domain, in other words, something that, you know, Sean Hannity and Fox News have pretended to be against for years. But the supporters of Trump, they don't care. Yeah, eminent domain. Yeah, sure. Keystone XL, grab up all the land you need to make that happen. They don't care about that. They also don't care about the virtues, as Trump has touted, the virtues of single payer health care, which he has called for. Trump supporters, notes Klein, would be fine with more government spending on, say, infrastructure. By the way, same as Bernie Sanders is calling for more money for infrastructure, which then when government spends money on infrastructure, it leads to jobs, it improves the economy. Well, both Sanders and Trump have called for that, and it's very popular.
You are listening to yesterday's broadcast. Some of the information has changed since that time.
So Trump supporters would be fine with that, says Klein. They haven't particularly paid much attention to fights about the chairmanship of congressional committees. They'd be fine with doubling corporate export-import bank subsidies, something that is also anathema to actual conservatives. They're okay with it if Trump tells them that it would help to crush China, which also, by the way, a muscular foreign policy is also not particularly conservative. Greg Sargent goes on to say, another way to say this might be Republican voters supporting Trump actually think government should be able to play a constructive role in making the economy work for them. In other words, they perhaps feel minimal attachment to the idea that free markets are the be-all and end-all solution, or to the idea that their leader's primary role should be to restrain and roll back government, to beat back the growth of the regulatory and welfare state, because doing so will unshackle the pent-up forces that could otherwise lift the fortunes of working and middle-class Americans. Yes, that is something that Donald Trump is calling for, using the government to float all boats. And his supporters, which is a plurality of Republican voters at this point, haven't batted an eye at it. They are just fine. Why? Because they are not actually conservatives. They have been pretending to be conservatives because Fox News told them that they were conservatives. They are not. They are nothing of the sort. And they never have been. Words mean something. And so it's not just the Fox News. It's folks, Democrats, you know, often refer to anybody who is Republican as a conservative. That is not conservatism. That is not conservatism. What George W. Bush did was not conservatism. What Donald Trump is calling for is not conservatism. The bulk of what Fox News calls for is not conservatism. These are just lies. That is just branding. And frankly, it's a gift. It's a gift to Republicans to call them conservative, because the word conservative is, it has at least been very popular, more so than liberal. So anyway, it just drives me crazy. Trump, not a conservative, and yet right now, at least, he seems to be speeding towards the Republican nomination for president. We'll see what folks in Iowa have to say about it, and then in New Hampshire and so forth. One more. Do I have time for one more? Very, very quickly. All right. Donald Trump has been trying over the past several weeks to make the folks in Iowa believe that he is an evangelical Christian. And he attended services over the weekend at the First Christian Orchard Campus in Iowa. That's a non-denominational church in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He and his wife, Melania, and two staffers took communion when it was passed. But Trump momentarily was confused, and he mistook the silver plates circulated around the auditorium for communion, and he dug several bills out of his pocket to put into the, what is it called, the communion tray? I don't know. You're asking the wrong guy. But that was not the offering plate. That was for communion, but Donald Trump was ready to put dollar bills into it. He's good at this. As Trump was leaving, one of the church pastors put his hand on Trump's shoulder and offered him prayer. And, Donald Trump will need those prayers, as will Iowa, as will the rest of the country, as this fine mess moves forward and voting is now underway. So much more on the Iowa caucuses on tomorrow's program. Until then, if you missed any portion of today's, you can always download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes. You can find me and follow me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. And you can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. I'd love to hear from you. bradcast@bradblog.com. Maybe we'll read some of them on tomorrow's show. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and, of course, to my guest today, Jim Norikis of fair.org. That's it. Until we see you again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.